Before I do introduce our speaker, just like to acknowledge the Kaurna people on whose land the University of Adelaide's campuses and many other things have been built. We're very fortunate that Maria Espinosa is in Adelaide for the University of Adelaide's Creative Writing Program, and we have been able to snaffle her for this evening. Maria is a novelist, a poet, a translator, a teacher. She also has a daughter who's an artist, and I feel some warmth towards her because I too have a daughter who's an artist. She comes from an artistic family. Her father was a sculptor, her mother was a poet, and she herself has, as I said, many talents. She's written a number of novels: Incognito, Journey of a Secret Jew, Dark Plums, Longing, which is a prize-winning novel, and Dying Unfinished, which also is a prize-winning novel. She's published two collections of poems. She's a versatile and widely read novelist. Her topic is a difficult one, so I won't say what it is, even though I've got it written in front of me, because I'd like her to talk about it.
Thank you, Oliver. Well, I'm really pleased to be here with you, and I'm delighted that you invited me here to speak. And thank you very much. I'm just delighted to be here in Adelaide and meet people here. I'm just really happy here. So, the topic of the talk was Let the Crazy Child Write and Holding to One's Personal Vision. So I was in my hotel room today figuring out how to work with all this. And I went back to the crazy child and back to when I was 19 and I was certifiably crazy. And one of the most influential books I ever read was something called Becoming a Writer by a woman named Dorothea Brand, written in the 1930s. It's been reprinted many, many times. And what she said, what she wrote was, just write stream of consciousness, maybe 20 minutes a day, set a kitchen timer. Don't even read what you write necessarily. Don't judge it, don't cross out one word, just write, write, write. No editing, nothing. And she said, after 3 days, you will be amazed at what starts to come out of your unconscious. She was also quite mystical, and she got into all kinds of mystical things. And she was also very hard on discipline. She said, if you can't make yourself write at a certain time of day every day, forget it. Well, I couldn't. And here I am, still writing. Okay, so this for me was really, really like a jewel of advice that I have kept to all my life. Although the contents of the stream of consciousness really changed different phases of my life. And how many of you have done this kind of writing? Yeah. I'm interested, how many of you are writers? Okay, good. So you know what I'm talking about then. And the rest of you may know what I'm talking about. Because it's, you know, pretty... It's just very good advice, and I think this is kind of the nugget from which hundreds of books on writing have derived. There's another book called Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg, and she essentially says the same thing. She had one writer, I think, who wrote the same word over and over and over again for 3 weeks. And why did he have to write this word over and over and over? And finally he broke through and all kinds of things began to emerge, but he had to get through that. So this is one thing. And then I have a friend named Clive Mattson, a writer, and he actually wrote a book called Let the Crazy Child Write, because he said if you're trying to edit and criticize why you're trying to be creative, it's like driving a car and you've got one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake, which is really true. So it's really kind of a left brain, right brain activity. But I find that if I need to take a really messy, chaotic narrative and look at it, what am I going to make out of it? And if I want to create a structure, I have to be in a very relaxed alpha state sort of between waking and dreaming, ideally, to best use my left brain. And this is increasingly hard for me today because of all the things coming at me from the email, Facebook, Twitter, constant media. You know, you go into a cafe and you've got the sports TV here and you've got the music here and you've got everything going on. And somehow life seems much busier and more jagged than it did 20 or 30 years ago. And I also think we feel all the electronic radio and television waves and cell phone waves coming through us, even if we're not hooked in. They're going through the air and they're going somewhere. So stream of consciousness and personal vision. I began writing really not to go crazy when I was about 19. I was in a family where perceptions were denied. And if I said the sky was blue, they said, no, you're nuts, the sky is black. So I began writing down my impressions just to keep sane. And also at that point, I was in late adolescence and so much was coming through and I had to just write and write and write to give some kind of a form to all this energy that was coming through me or else I was going to go off the deep end. And the only thing that comes that's similar to this, I think of, is many years later in the 60s, I took, not that many years later, but years later in the 60s, I took LSD. And it was about 1965, and my friends were all taking LSD, and so we were all trying this. And I was very careful beforehand. I cleaned my apartment, I washed my hair, I put on a long red and gold dress. I sent my daughter to a babysitter, and I got out exactly the books and the music I wanted, and a lot of paper. And I was with a friend, and he said, you know, what are you doing writing all these words? Why don't you just bliss out? And I couldn't, because everything was coming down. There was so much energy, and if I didn't express it in some form, I really thought I was going to lose it, and I probably would have lost it. I needed that structure. I needed that form, which brings me to discipline and the necessity, you know, I'm sure, you know, the necessity of having a structure, a discipline to encapsulate all that energy or to even coax it to come. Okay, so we have the left brain and we have the right brain. And again, I began writing in order not to go crazy and to keep my own vision of things. And I'd also read a lot. So I had standards of what I liked and what I didn't like. But I think the reading is so important in deciding what you like and what your own vision is, which you really only find out by writing, or if you're a painter, by painting, or if you're a musician, by playing music, composing. It's only by doing that you find out what's inside. And so this brings me to my very first book, my first novel, which was called Dark Plums. And it is not autobiographical, I have to say. It's about a prostitute in the 50s in Manhattan. But what is autobiographical is the emotional content of looking, being really quite desperately looking for love, whatever the cost. And I was thinking about, what is prostitution? Is selling yourself in marriage the same as selling yourself on the street? And at this point, I picked up George Sand, who had precisely the same kinds of thoughts I was having. And I was fascinated. She had not been translated into English. This particular book had not been, called Lelia. And I had not envisioned translating it, but I was annoyed that I couldn't find it in English. And she asked this question, what is the difference? You know, what is the lot? What is the fate of women? Women are fated to either be nuns or sell themselves as prostitutes or on the marriage block. For her, it was the same. And I thought about my parents' marriage, and I thought about how my father had been an artist, was an artist, and my mother supported him by being a secretary at the cost of her own creativity. And I thought, this to me is a kind of prostitution. So I began thinking about all this. And eventually it became this novel, which is more tied to George Sand than people realize. I love George Sand. This was 19th century, it was naive, it was romantic. And today, if you started to write like this, it would be stand-up comedy. today the thing is to be hip and terse and with it. I'll read you a couple of paragraphs of this and you'll see what I mean. But I could indulge in this because I was only translating her. So it wasn't me, it was George Sand, 19th century. First page. This is Stenio to Lelia. Lelia is the tragic heroine. And by the way, this was George Sand's most personal and autobiographical novel. And she later expurgated it. She wrote a cleaned up edition. As she got more respectable in old age, she sort of renounced all the things of her youth a lot. Okay, Stenio to Lelia, who are you and why does your love cause so much evil? There must be some terrible mystery in you, something unknown to men. You are certainly not formed from dust and animated with the same life we are. You are an angel or a demon, but you are not human. Why do you hide your nature and origin from us? Why do you live among us when we aren't enough for you and we can't understand you? If you come from God, speak and we will adore you. If you come from hell, you come from hell. You are so beautiful and so pure. Would an evil spirit have your divine gaze, your harmonious voice, and your words which inspire the soul and transport it to God's throne? So this is, 19th century romanticism, and she goes on. It's quite a fascinating book, because as a novel it doesn't work at all, but as a story of a woman really searching very earnestly, what is God? What is there a God? What is the meaning of life? What is the origin of the universe? What is the role of a man and of a woman? Why? And then she's concerned because she cannot seem to love, and she's having a lot. She's frigid, and why is she frigid? And what is holding her back? And then it's played out. Then she has a sister who's a courtesan, and there's a mad priest, and there's a poet in love with her, and there's a stoic. So there's a whole, and she said, these are all parts of me. Later on, André Maurois wrote a biography called Lelia or The Life of George Sand, because again, he considered it her autobiographical book in a sense. So people thought it had been translated and it never had been. So now I'll read my first page of Dark Plums. A man in a pale green shirt was watching her. Adrian could feel his gaze as she walked along Broadway in the steamy afternoon heat. In this humidity, her bleached hair grew frizzy. She was tired from working at the office of Eureka Fabrics all day. Her high heels were beginning to hurt her swollen feet, while her dress, damp with perspiration, stuck too tightly to her large buttocks and breasts. When the light changed, a man crossed the street, following her as she made her way uptown towards the 49th Street subway stop. Three black teenage girls swung past him, laughing raucously, momentarily obscuring him from view. His attention made her spine tingle. This stretch of Broadway above 42nd Street never failed to fascinate her. The crowd seemed to throw out waves of electricity, poisoned reds and greens, golds and heavy purples. After walking just a short block, she would feel breathless and drained of energy. Two boys with tight trousers and slick hair were standing at a hot dog concession, They nudged each other, laughing, as Adrian walked by. What is so peculiar about me, she wondered. Why were people always laughing behind her back? She knew they did in the office, just as they had in high school. Gerald was the only one who hadn't jeered. Gerald, where are you? She wondered. What are you doing at this very moment? Do you ever think about me? She glanced at every man on the street now, as if by some miracle, Gerald might appear. But he was back in Houston, Texas. Gull girl, he used to call her in moments of tenderness, when he still loved her. You have the breasts of a gull girl. Noises of traffic and people, blaring music from a record shop, and a slightly nauseating stench all assailed her senses. Further up 43rd Street, a huge shovel swung through the air with a pendulous motion. As she slowed to glance at her reflection in a window, the man in the pale green shirt overtook her. "Hello there," he said. Transfixed, Adrian stood absolutely still while people continued to press around them. Her image faded in the window glass. With his small eyes and narrow reddish face, he reminded her of an animal that had been trapped underground. Then he reached out and held one of her hands. Empty and lightheaded as she was feeling, there was comfort in his touch. As he moved a step closer, she held her breath. When he stroked her fingers, she fought an urge to press herself against him. His warmth was protection against the waves of human electricity all around her. She tried to wrench away, however, but he only gripped her more firmly. "Come, follow me." His voice was commanding with a rough edge. In spite of herself, she wanted him to hold her and soothe the anguish in her, even if only for an instant. "Love me, take me in your arms." Oh, this was crazy, she knew. Yet she felt as if the crowd all around could suck her into itself and leave her as hollow as a gourd, while this stranger's touch defined her body and gave her a sensation of being solid. So that's the beginning of Adrian. Adventures. So far, any questions?
Can I ask, do you write because you have an idea, or do you want to write and you look for an idea?
Oh, the idea definitely comes first. Yeah. And then fleshing out the idea. This went through a lot of incarnations. It started actually a very different story. I was living in Greece. I was there for the summer. I was about 19 years old, and I had an Olivetti typewriter with me, and it was the first time I was able to actually create a structure for writing. I was on a place called Lindos, which is now a big vacation spot, but then it was still a tiny little town. And so I was very overpowered by the Greek landscape, and so this was originally about a Greek girl with a very cold mother. And she wanders around the countryside looking for love. And in the end, she's murdered by a Greek shepherd whom she thinks is Christ. Because she's in the meantime, she takes up with some gypsies. She has all kinds of adventures. So that was just a short story. And I didn't know what to do with it. And then I enlarged it, and it became something else. And then finally, it became this. So it was the idea of looking for love in all the wrong places, essentially. But this kind of desperation for human touch and contact and naivete at the same time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other? Yeah.
Can I just say that it seems to me that both the readings that and what you just alluded to about the shepherd and somebody mistaken for Christ, that there's actually a thread in all the writings and in your book, you know, somebody saying to somebody, "Come follow me."
Yeah.
And the effect that had to call to somebody. I mean, it's like all the writing has a really deep, and maybe all art does, you know, that spiritual.
It really is.
Hope.
Yeah.
To sort it. And to really sort it for the writer.
Thank you for saying that, because that makes me think of the next thing, which is about the personal vision. It makes when I first wrote the book, nobody would publish it except, why don't you make it a little bit more graphic and make it a memoir and we'll sell it as, you know, the confessions of a real hooker. And I said, but that isn't what I want. I'm thinking of German expressionists and I'm trying to express the psychic and the spiritual and the emotional and the physical, all the aspects of this woman's experience. And you people aren't getting it. And so it was considered pornographic for a long time or just a weird novel. Finally, many years later, a Latino press affiliated with the University of Houston published it. And they were the first to see, hey, there's more to this book. And by then, the times had changed. Again, talking to personal vision, by then, what was considered edgy in the 70s was really, by the 90s, was, oh, okay. And the other thing that struck me was if I had written this as a man with a man's name or a man's initials, it would have had a much easier time being published. And it would have been also reviewed differently. And because people tend to think that whatever a woman writes is autobiographical. A man, they give him the luxury of some distance. If she writes about murdering an aunt, you know, well, who did you murder? So it's really, there is a double standard at work very much. And there is the fact that what's popular changes. Oh yeah, people didn't like the fact that it was depressing at the end. The characters, what redeeming social value did these characters have? Again, I don't think a character has to have a redeeming social value. I'm talking about the complexities of people. I mean, look at Dostoevsky. What redeeming social value did Raskolnikov have? So again, eventually people come around or they don't come around, but so there it is. The next novel had a hard time getting published. It was also considered edgy and on the edge of being too graphic. And this is autobiographical. This is called Longing, and it's probably my favorite novel. And it's the story of a New York Jewish girl, not very Jewish, but New York, and married to a Chilean writer, and how both their personalities and the families they're coming out of and the cultures they come out of really conflict, and especially how it affects him coming from Paris, where they've met, to the United States, and he was one of the first waves of Latinos to come to the United States. Now there's a huge influx. Albuquerque, where I'm living now, is 50% Hispanic, but back in the 60s, he was one of the first, so it was harder. So I'll read a little bit from that, too. Okay, they meet, and I'll just tell the story, is that they meet in Paris, and they begin living together. She gets pregnant, they marry, they have a baby. They have a very stormy life, and a very open and difficult sexual relationship. He wants to seduce everyone, and he wants her to be free. He also has a relationship with her mother. Which is not what it seems on the surface. So I'm going to read a section where she feels, because she has always lacked a kind of closeness with her mother, she's just given birth to a baby, her daughter, and she feels that in order to be a good mother, she has to have the experience of intimacy with another woman. And so he's supportive about this. He understands. So I'll read this scene. Rosa and Antonio met Tanya on the street one day as they were walking the baby in the carriage. This was the young girl whom Antonio had led into Rosa's arms and into their bed. It was bitterly cold. Tanya, tall and slender with pale skin, pale blonde hair and delicate features, swathed in a black fur coat, seemed glad to see them. Impulsively, Rosa asked her to spend the night. Antonio urged Tanya to come. In fact, he overcame her hesitations and said that he himself would pick her up in her little room on the Ile de la Cité and walk with her to their apartment. "Rosa needs you," he said. "I think maybe you need her too. You need each other." Rosa was startled. "Why are you doing this?" she asked as they walked on afterwards. She covered the baby more securely in her blanket. "I cannot bear it when someone I am close to suffers," he said. "I sense your needs, even before you yourself are aware of them." Rosa found herself sobbing. "I don't know why I want this," she said. "I want to be normal, but I want to make love with her. Somehow I feel I need to do this so I can be a good mother to the baby. I don't understand." She sobbed as they walked on in the cold. He led her into the cafe for a glass of brandy, comforting her. "You are honnête," he said. "You are trying to be who you truly are so your repressions don't harm the baby." "I don't understand," she moaned. She lifted the brandy to her lips. It burned her throat. His arms were around her as he rocked. His arm was around her as he rocked the carriage back and forth. At that moment, she loved him more than anything else in the world, more than she ever had. She turned and softly kissed his dry lips. "I love you so much." "For a while," he said, dismissing with a shrug. "For a while you'll love me." "I will always love you. You have saved me. You understand me. You aren't like other men. You don't look down on me and despise me and try to destroy me." "Antonio, I love you so much," she said, breaking into tears again. "Yes," he said, "bodies in bed. That's flesh, sacks of flesh. And love is something else again. Even little children love. Perhaps you've heard of a child of 5 who is heartbroken when its playmate leaves. Children, too, can die of broken hearts." "Sentimental," she murmured. "That's sentimental. I hate sentimentality, but I adore you." He downed the rest of her brandy and ordered another. Closeness to Tanya would promote closeness to the infant, she believed. Closeness she had never gotten from another woman. She needed that closeness right now in order to mother an infant girl, in order to not shove that infant girl out the window or down a toilet or down a dark air shaft or underneath a freshet of water from the fountain or into the oven to suffocate. "I need to be loved in order to love at all. Going back in time to pick up dropped stitches as in knitting." So that's one thing. And then I'd like to read a short section here about Antonio. He's a writer, and he's a frustrated writer. And Antonio's article was published in El Mercurio, and his article on Chilean expatriates in La Nación. While these minor successes gave him brief flashes of joy, they did not dispel the huge dark cloud of fear surrounding him. In mid-afternoon, he pushed aside the manuscript, which he'd begun working on again. He walked through the streets for hours thinking about it, stopping for an occasional drink to warm himself. It's winter in Paris. He hadn't eaten since yesterday, but he wasn't hungry. The mere thought of food nauseated him. At 9 in the evening, he found himself in a cafe near Montmartre. There he put a coin into the payphone and called Khalil's hotel. For weeks he'd called, only to be told that the film producer was out. But this time he heard Khalil's voice. "What can I do for you?" Khalil asked. "How are you?" "Fine, fine. What can I do for you?" Khalil repeated. "I want to know if you have any work for me," said Antonio. "Yes, yes, I'll see what I can do for you, Antonio. I'm just on my way out when you called. I'll get in touch with you." Khalil hung up. An icy wind blew from the street. "Merde," muttered Antonio, "the bastard. They all forget about Antonio after they've used him. I'm like electricity," Rosa says. "They want to keep their distance. Merde." He lurched to the bar and asked for a cognac. Then he felt in his pocket for his address book. He would call the Spanish Marquise, that tall, distinguished redhead with the sad eyes he'd met once, a charming woman who seemed drawn to him. Perhaps she would like some photos taken, or perhaps he could do some painting on her apartment. But when he felt through his pockets, he couldn't find the small, thick, black, leather-bound book. He went back to the payphone, but he couldn't find it there either. He hadn't used the address book to call Khalil because he knew that number by heart. Merde! Hundreds of names, addresses, and phone numbers that were rooted in his past, now lost. The address book was 7 years old. He'd brought it with him from Chile. He could never reach the Spanish Marquis now. He banged his fist against the wall. Inside his head, the gnome shouted with glee while the Spanish nobleman strode back and forth in front of a moonlit castle, sniffed jasmine blossoms, and waited for his lady love, unconcerned with Antonio's dilemma. Merde, merde. He sat down at a table near the phone, put his face in his hands, and wept. What a damned fool he was. No matter how hard he struggled to succeed in the world, another part of him, endowed with superior intelligence and cunning, would defeat him and howl with laughter. Something was breaking in him, something outside his power to control. The racket of people inside the cafe drummed in his ears, glasses clinking, voices, laughter, the pinball machine, someone else on the phone, a pimp talking to one of his ladies, ordering her down on the street, insolent, a cigarette hanging from his mouth. The foulness of humanity overwhelmed him. If only he could finish his novel. The pages appeared helter-skelter in his mind. What literary gifts he formerly possessed seemed to belong to someone else, certainly not him as he was now. Ah, if only it were finished, then he might win the Prix Fomentor. Perhaps it could be published simultaneously in Chile and Spain, and then translated into French, Italian, German, English. People would no longer scoff. He would no longer be Antonio the Fool. Rose's family would no longer look down their noses at him. No longer would he be a pitiable fellow. So, again, any questions or comments? This is both sides of him, the generous side and the self-defeating side, and then there's other parts where he goes off and is really quite abusive. And then we come to Incognito, which there's a sequel to Longing which comes, but I think I'll do Incognito. But, okay, I'm from a family that my mother would keep saying, well, we're Jewish by origin. We're sort of like, we're not really Jewish. Now you see it, now you don't. Mm-hmm. And I would say, well, if we were in Germany, Hitler would have still put us in an oven and wouldn't have made this distinction. But and her family was evasive about all this, too, very much trying to assimilate into American society and really let go of their roots, which was very hard, I think, because if you don't have roots, you're really adrift and you lose a lot of strength. And so all my childhood in our dining room, there was a portrait of a woman dressed in velvet and lace, and she had a rather forbidding expression. She didn't look like somebody who was going to be much fun. And I was told that it was a copy of an 18th century portrait that hung in Brussels and that this woman had come from Spain. And I thought, well, wait a minute. If the family was Jewish, how could they live in Spain in the 18th century? Something doesn't click. So then I realized they must have been underground. They must have gone underground with their religion, their culture. And I began imagining back. And so this novel was the result of that. And so I'll read again the beginning, a little bit of that. Okay, he had been 7 years old when the Jews, this is Cadiz, 1492. He had been 7 years old when the Jews left Spain. On a hot, dry day in late July, thousands of them began to swarm into the city of Cadiz, choking the dusty roads as they made their way to the port. At times, the group would be singing. Some blew trumpets and played timbrels. Sometimes younger ones danced, but most simply looked worn and exhausted, their faces and bodies covered with grime. They carried crying babies in their weary arms. Swollen feet were wrapped in rags. The more fortunate rode pack mules or wagons. Alfonso Valdez de Echevarria watched the Jews from a balcony of his family's house, along with other members of the household. Fascinated by this extraordinary spectacle, he had watched ever since the church bells rang at dawn. A tall girl dressed in scarlet led a group of other young girls in a whirling dance. Their bright skirts flared and their long hair billowed out as they moved to the beat of drums and the ringing of timbrels. An old man collapsed on the ground. Two younger men came to his rescue. One supported his head while the other held a flask of water to his lips. For months now, the child at Alfonso had listened to the priest Bernardo rage against these Jews in his sermons. The priest rejoiced at their departure. He preached that these people had burrowed like worms into the soul of Spain, as if it were a fresh, firm apple. In a voice ringing with emotion, Father Bernardo spoke of limpieza, or cleanliness of blood. Now at last, Spain would be pure. "Why are Jews evil?" Alfonso asked his nursemaid, a girl with long black braids. "They kill children and crucify them," she said, "as our Lord was crucified. The men have monkey's tails and they bleed like women," said a stableman, leering down at the child. "Oh, hush," cried the nursemaid. "Some have cloven hoofs. Sancto Jesu, they are the devil's people. They're moneylenders and thieves, as sly as foxes," said an older man who had run up considerable gambling debts. "Poor wretches," murmured a laundress. Alfonso looked down at a boy his older size who was kicking the dust as he trudged along. He wondered if the other child concealed a monkey's tail inside his baggy breeches. Alfonso's mother, Doña Luisa, had a headache that throbbed as if the devil himself were plaguing her. She felt faint from the heat, and perspiration soaked her silk dress beneath the armpits. She wished she could give water to these wretched Jews, but trying to allay their thirst would be like trying to irrigate a desert with water from a dipper. The servant's remarks distressed her. However, she did not think it prudent to intervene. Her own fear wound so tightly inside that she felt as if she were choking. The fear was always with her, lying in wait like a coiled snake. Over the years, authorities within the church had created such an atmosphere that a mere word, the omission of a prayer, a thoughtless remark could arouse suspicion. So the story goes on from there, and Alfonso learns when he becomes adolescent that his family is indeed secretly Jewish, and that the family tree of old Spanish pure blood is a fake, and that the family priest himself is a secret Jew. So he feels really torn. He learns this in Amsterdam, by the way, because his father, who is a traitor, has taken them to Amsterdam and has told him in the safety of a foreign country. And he has been brought up as a Catholic, and he's a very sincere Catholic. So to have his faith, you know, what he thinks he is, just pulled out from under him is very heartrending and devastating. And he seeks refuge in studying the Kabbalah with the aid of his priest. And in actual historical fact, many Jews, who were conversos or Catholics on the surface, tried to reconcile their sort of split allegiance by studying the Kabbalah. It was a kind of a bridge. So eventually he flees to Portugal. He's imprisoned. He escapes. He marries. His wife and children are killed in a pogrom in Portugal. He goes on to Amsterdam, to Brazil, so forth. And I don't know how much more time we have, or if I should open it up for questions. All right, I'll talk a little bit about Dying Unfinished. This is the sequel to Longing. By the way, this, which was so hard to get published, is now, how can I say, it's won prizes, it's really considered, it's critically acclaimed, finally. But it took a long, long time. And this has been, too.
Did you stay with the same publisher for each book?
No, these were the first two publishers. Was the first publisher. And unfortunately, we had a big difference. Someone wanted very much to make a movie of this, and the publisher nixed it. He was infamous for nixing movie contracts. And I was upset to the point of saying, I'm going to take back my rights when my contract is up. And so that, consequently, it's out of print. However, my current publisher says he's going to reprint these two books. And I'm hoping he'll do it as print on demand. He's planning to do them as e-books, but I'm going to ask him, please do it print on demand. So this one, okay, in Longing, Antonio has an affair with Eleanor, Rose's mother. And it is not really lust. It's really a lot of complex factors that go into their relationship. And there is a real psychic closeness between them. In fact, there's a whole scene I didn't read where Rosa is in anguish because she sees what's going on between Antonio and Eleanor. And it torments her. And at the same time, she feels great sorrow for her mother's life. And she wants to say, here, you want him taken. And so this happened in reality, and it was hard. And so in this book, long after my mother died, I'd really tried to make peace with her. And the only way I could do it was by trying to understand her and putting myself into her psyche. So it became this novel called Dying Unfinished, which became first her voice, and then my voice kept creeping in. So it was a dialogue between the two of us. So that's this book. And I'll read a little bit from that. I wish I had read the passage now about Antonio and Eleanor. Okay. Okay, this is Rosa in Bloom. Let's see. Okay, here, I'll just read a bit of this if I've got time. This is Rosa at her craziest before she meets Antonio. 1957, Rosa in Bloom. At 18, I was at the height of my beauty and power, yet I squandered these riches like an heiress, determined to gamble away her fortune. I grew to enjoy venturing to the edge of safety. What saved me was the sharpness of perceptions when I was in physical danger. At other times, I could be blind and deaf to what was going on. It took a life and death situation or drugs to shake me out of my trance. That summer, after a year in college, I found an office job in Manhattan where I rented a tiny room for $6 a week, barely large enough for me to lie on the narrow bed and spread my arms out from wall to wall. I spent most of my free time on the streets. My purse contained a diaphragm and a battered case, cosmetics, scraps of paper with names and phone numbers, a notebook with poems and story fragments, Kleenex, a small bottle of brandy, and always a book, Chekhov, George Eliot, Blake, or Yeats, something classic to balance the scattered craziness of my life. In the evenings, I took a modern dance class, but my life was so chaotic, I often arrived late or failed to show up at all. I spent hours wandering the streets, and I talked to people in coffee shops, bars, subways. As if I were a spider spinning a magnetic web, I drew out their secrets. That was a skill I learned from you, Mother. I knew so little about life, and I wanted to learn all at once. By going to bed with men, I thought I was getting to know something essential about human nature. If the fool persists in her folly, she will become wise. That is, if she survives. I created identities for myself, false names, false pasts. If one grew painful, I simply slipped it off as a snake sheds its skin and would emerge as someone else. In the morning, I might awaken in a stranger's bed after only a few hours of sleep. Then I'd dash off to work. During lunch, I answered ads for sleazy modeling jobs, while other girls in the office munched tuna sandwiches in the employees' lounge. Along with sleazy photographers, I met real artists, actors, musicians. I had an ability to arouse their protectiveness. They wanted to fatten up my skinny body, clothe me, take me in like a stray cat. One photographer showed me pictures in fashion magazines of his former wife. He wanted to make me over as he had with her. "Sweetheart, you need to get your hair done. Sweep it back like this. Pluck your brows. I can show you how to dress. I could get you into Vogue." My favorite dress that summer was a sea green sheath. One morning, I discovered dried menstrual stains on the back, and I realized I'd been wandering around like this for days, spaced out. I was not in control, and it frightened me. Spacey, so spacey, who was I? The real me, not one, but many identities, emerged in frightening ways. "Are you in drag?" a stranger on the street asked one day. Had he discerned that beneath the thick makeup and clinking jewelry, at times I felt half male, with my bitten fingernails and clumsy grooming? This encounter had a dreamlike quality of truth. Spacey and crazy as I was, I possessed a kind of magnetism, an electric voltage I had no idea how to handle. I drew people into my life. In times of danger, a slumbering sorceress awakened. The sorceress could walk along a lonely street, radiating waves of protective energy. The sorceress could glimpse inside someone's mind when her survival was at stake. But in some ways, I was pitiably weak, chaotic, panic-stricken, as though I had ingested the panic inside my father and swallowed it whole. When I was in high school, sometimes he drove me home at night under streetlights that had an eerie orange glow. He'd ask what I was thinking, uneasy that he couldn't enter my mind. The anxiety in his voice and his nerves penetrated me. "Mother, I took on your thoughts and feelings too. Where did you begin? Where did I end? The boundaries between us were liquid. I wasn't yet a human being in my own right, but a mixture of conflicting elements." So that's a bit of that story. It goes on, it covers 70 years, really. It starts with the mother's childhood in the early 20th century, and it goes through until her death in the 80s. Yeah?
How long did it take you to write that novel?
Oh, a long time. Too long. All my novels took a long time. You know, I think I can dash this off in a few months, and it would years and years and years. Yeah. Do I have more time to read, or should I open it up for questions?
I think if we could open it up now.
All right. Yeah. Thank you so much. I would be welcome. Yeah, please. Please ask me some questions.
Yeah, thanks very much. You talked initially about overcoming doubts when you get down to writing. Can you tell me about the doubts that you may have had in terms of research and getting inside the mind of a 16th century Spaniard, if I got that right?
Oh,
And another question, well, it's another sort of kind of authenticity, which I think you've probably answered, but yes, getting inside the mind of a male character.
Excuse me?
Getting inside the mind of a male character. I think you've probably answered that, but anyway, both of them.
Okay. Let's see, the 16th century, that was fun. That was so much more fun and easier than writing. I could have gone on doing research forever and ever and ever. At one point I decided I had to stop and just write the book. Can you hear me? Okay. It fascinated me, the 15th, 14th, 15th, and 16th century, because also there was a parallel between the Inquisition then and the whole era of the World War II and post-World War II that I saw. Okay, there were doubts as far as writing. Every day that I sit down to write, I have to overcome a fear. It still feels like diving off a high board, even though I've been writing all my life, it still is a scary thing to sit down and write. Although I write compulsively, I mean, I'll write diaries and fragments and stories and dialogue, but if I sit down and, okay, this is the novel, this is chapter 13, and I have to get on with it. Whoops, well, let me see. I need to do the laundry, and I need to call somebody. So it's I really have to kind of get at myself to write. And then once I start, then it starts building up its own momentum. It's just those, that first beginning that's so hard. Every morning.
The other question was about getting into the mind of a male character.
And sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's hard. It depends on the male character. With Antonio, I knew him so well that I didn't have a hard time, or at least I felt I didn't. And with other, I don't know how accurately I felt I was getting into their mind, but I felt I was. And with Alfonso, I don't know. The novel I'm writing now is centered around a male character, and I'm having a much harder time with him because I have, it's based on somebody I know, but I'm transforming it, and I'm having a hard time with him. So it varies.
You said earlier, and I was quite surprised, when you were asked a few minutes back how long it took you to write them, you said too long. And I don't understand what that means.
Oh, it means that according to my own standards, hey, I should have dashed off this book in a year. It shouldn't have taken me 10 years to write this book. So that's what I'm saying. I should have written many more books by now and so forth. So I'm hard on myself, and yet at the same time, I'm not. And I get bored with writing on the same book for year after year. I think, why isn't this done?
In relation to your writing, I was really fascinated with the lovely blend you have between description of, like, the person in the street going to what they're wearing, to their interior feelings, to the action. You seem to blend that so well, and I just wondered, are you conscious of that blending all the time, of talking about giving the description of the context, the interior feelings, the action, because you see that seems to be the real power, I think, of I've seen of the little snippets you've given us.
Oh.
You don't go on too long with description, which some people do, and you think, oh, this is getting boring. You just give enough to tantalise and set the essence of it in those things.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think it comes from writing poetry, because my first writings were poetry, and I read a lot of poetry, and I could do it in a much shorter time. I was working full time, I was a single mother, I had 15 minutes a day to write, so it was easier to write a poem. But even before that, I was writing poetry, and I think it's a kind of instinctive thing where they blend, they all blend. Another enormous influence on me, and I'm almost hesitate to say this, was Anais Nin. How many of you know her work? Because it's so fashionable to put her down. And she's known for her erotic writings, which was not what drew me to her. When I was very young, I found an article about her in a Harvard magazine. And I wrote to her, and she was very generous and wrote back, and I sent her some poems, and she was incredibly encouraging. And then in the Rare Books Library of Columbia, I found a little tiny book of her early short stories called Under a Glass Bell. And I was just drawn because she wrote as a woman. And that the women writers I had been reading had, in my mind, had been writing as men. And so here was somebody writing out of a sensual and emotional and psychic womanliness, and she also is quite poetic, so I think that, and she did this kind of blending. And in fact, she was really criticized very harshly because when her books came out in the 40s in New York, they would say, well, where are the windows and the walls, and why isn't she describing, you know, these, and I thought, this isn't what she's doing, she's doing something else. And so I try to put enough detail to give a sense of it, but I don't want to get boring with too much. So it's hard to do the balance.
I'm interested with some of your work, you're writing from experience or from people you know or people that have been in your life. What are some of the legal ramifications if people recognize themselves, or have you ever
is what's scaring me about the novel now. Because the other novels, the people were safely dead. Or my daughter, who's a little, appears as an angelic being. I have to say, my father did read this book, and it hurt him deeply, and at the same time, I think he sort of expected it, because he sort of knew what was coming. And on the other, and then I have two brothers. One brother never read it, and the other brother said it saved his sanity, and it helped him understand the whole family dynamics, and he was, he felt that it had sort of, a kind of cleansing of the family tree in some way. So, with the novel I'm writing now, I'm having a harder time because the people are alive and I could get sued, so I have to transform things quite a lot. But in order to write the novel, I have to start out with their characteristics or I totally lose the sense of it. So I'm going to have to, that's why I'm having a hard time with this book.
Just one more question.
You know who I really have just discovered is Brian Castro, and I really loved, when I met him a year ago, he gave me a book called The Garden Book, and I loved it. I read it several times and really am drawn with that book. And I know pitifully little about Australian writers, so I'm eager to learn more because I think there's a great gulf.
I think that's a very nice and polite point to draw the talk to a close and thank Maria very much. What we've had this evening is only a tiny fragment of what there is. I would urge any of you to Google, who do this sort of thing, to Google Maria Espinosa, and you'll find her blog and you'll read there what we got this evening. Incidentally, extraordinary sympathy for the underdog, extraordinary ability to describe the plight of the underdog, and also just a glimpse into the wideness of her culture, which she hasn't had time really this evening to share everything. I mean, how many people read George Gissing for pleasure today, for example? Anyway, it's been a privilege to listen to Maria and to learn a little about her. And so I ask you all to join with me in thanking her. But after that, there is a little bit of business. So let's thank Maria.
Thank you very much.